Well, the heads of Facebook, Google, and Twitter all appeared before the Senate Commerce Committee today to defend their business practices. The Democrats on the committee used their time to hold the CEOs accountable for their large media influence and to criticize the hearing as an election time show trial, while the Republicans were critical of potential suppression of conservative viewpoints. Good evening and welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Peter Slen. More on the tech CEOs hearing in a minute. In other news, the election continues to dominate official Washington, with Joe Biden voting in Delaware and President Trump holding rallies in Las Vegas and Arizona. And Democratic and Republican lawyers in Washington are already planning for a post-election legal battle as well. We'll start tonight in the U.S. Senate. Mark Zuckerberg, Sundar Pichai, and Jack Dorsey were all questioned virtually by the Senate Commerce Committee today. The topics discussed included censorship, monopoly power, the fate of local news, and whether tech platforms should be held liable for what's posted on their sites, which is known as Section 230 of the Communications Act in Washington speak. Here's Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey.
Section 230 is the most important law protecting internet speech, and removing Section 230 will remove speech from the internet. Section 230 gave internet services two important tools. The first provides immunity from liability for users' content. The second provides Good Samaritan protections for content moderation and removal, even of constitutionally protected speech, as long as it's done in good faith. That concept of good faith is what's being challenged by many of you today. Some of you don't trust we're acting in good faith. That's the problem I want to focus on solving. How do services like Twitter earn your trust? How do we ensure more choice in the market if we don't? There are three solutions we'd like to propose to address the concerns raised, all focused on services that decide to moderate or remove content. They could be expansions to Section 230, new legislative frameworks, or commitment to industry-wide self-regulation best practices. The first is requiring a services moderation process to be published. How are cases reported and reviewed? How are decisions made? What tools are used to enforce? Publishing answers to questions like these will make our process more robust and accountable to the people we serve. The second is requiring a straightforward process to appeal decisions made by humans or by algorithms. This ensures people can let us know when we don't get it right, so that we can fix any mistakes and make our processes better in the future. And finally, much of the content people see today is determined by algorithms, with very little visibility into how they choose what they show. We took a first step in making this more transparent by building a button to turn off our home timeline algorithms. It's a good start, but we're inspired by the market approach suggested by Dr. Stephen Wolfram before this committee in June 2019, enabling people to choose algorithms created by third parties to rank and filter their content is an incredibly energizing idea that's in reach.
And that was Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey before the Senate Commerce Committee. Now, the heads of Facebook and Google also called for reforming, but not eliminating, Section 230. Now, today's hearing was called after the New York Post ran stories about the business dealings of Hunter Biden and Twitter limited its distribution. Here's Senator Ted Cruz, Republican of Texas, asking Mr. Dorsey about that.
The New York Post isn't just some random guy tweeting. The New York Post has the fourth highest circulation of any newspaper in America. The New York Post is over 200 years old. The New York Post was founded by Alexander Hamilton. And your position is that you can sit in Silicon Valley and demand of the media that you can tell them what stories they can publish and you can tell the American people what reporting they can hear. Is that right?
No, this was a, you know, every person, every account, organization that signs up to Twitter agrees to a terms of service. Terms of service is
so media outlets must genuflect and obey your dictates if they wish to be able to communicate with readers. Is that right?
No, not at all. We recognized an error in this policy and specifically the enforcement.
You're still blocking their posts. You're still blocking their posts. Right now, today, you're blocking their posts.
We're not blocking the posts. Anyone can tweet.
Is the New York, Can the New York Post post on their Twitter account?
If they go into their account.
No, is your answer to that. No, unless they genuflect and agree with your dictates. Let me ask you something. You claimed it was because of a hacked materials policy. I find that facially highly dubious and clearly employed in a deeply partial way. Did Twitter block the distribution of the New York Times' story a few weeks ago that purported to be based on copies of President Trump's tax returns?
We didn't find that a violation of our terms of service and this policy in particular, because it was reporting about the material. It wasn't distributing the material.
Okay, well, that's actually not true. They posted what they purported to be original source materials, and federal law, federal statute makes it a crime, a federal felony, to distribute someone's tax returns against their knowledge. So that material was based on something that was distributed in violation of federal law, and yet Twitter gleefully allowed people to circulate that. But when the article was critical of Joe Biden, Twitter engaged in rampant censorship and silencing.
And again, we recognized errors in that policy. We changed it within 24 hours. This is.
But you're still blocking the New York Post. You haven't changed it.
We have changed it. They can log into their account, delete the original tweet.
You forced a Politico reporter to take down his post about the New York Post as well. Is that correct?
Within that 24-hour period, yes. But we, you know, as the policy has changed, anyone can tweet.
So Twitter takes the view. You can censor the New York Post. You can censor Politico. Presumably, you can censor the New York Times or any other media outlet. Mr. Dorsey, who the hell elected you and put you in charge of what the media are allowed to report and what the American people are allowed to hear? And why do you persist in behaving as a Democratic super PAC, silencing views to the contrary of your political beliefs?
Let's give Mr. Dorsey a few seconds to answer that, and then we'll have to conclude this segment.
Well, we're not doing that. And this is why I opened this hearing with calls for more transparency. We realize we need to earn trust more. We realize that more accountability is needed to show our intentions and to show the outcomes.
Thank you, Senator.
So I hear the concerns and acknowledge them, but we want to fix it with more transparency.
And that was Senator Ted Cruz questioning Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey. Senator Ed Markey, a Democrat, turned his attention to foreign interference in the U.S. election and social media posts by President Trump with this question to Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg.
The issue is not that the companies before us today are taking too many posts down. The issue is that they're leaving too many dangerous posts up. In fact, they're amplifying harmful content so that it spreads like wildfire and tortures our democracy. Mr. Zuckerberg, when President Trump posted on Facebook that when the looting starts, the shooting starts, you fail to take down that post. Within a day, the post had hundreds of thousands of shares and likes on Facebook. Since then, the president has gone on national television and told a hate group to, quote, stand by. And he has repeatedly refused to commit that he will accept the election results. Mr. Zuckerberg, can you commit that if the president goes on Facebook and encourages violence after election results are announced, that you will make sure your company's algorithms don't spread that content and you will immediately remove those messages?
Senator, yes. Incitement of violence is against our policy, and there are not exceptions to that, including for politicians.
There are exceptions, did you say?
There are not exceptions.
There are no exceptions, which is very important, because obviously there could be a message, the messages that are sent that could throw our democracy into chaos. And a lot of it can be and will be created if social media sites do not police what the president says.
And that was Massachusetts Democrat Ed Markey and the head of Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg. Some Democratic senators dismissed the hearing altogether, Brian Schatz of Hawaii called it a sham and said, quote, do not let U.S. senators bully you into carrying the water, end quote, for politicians seeking to discredit their opponents. And here is how Minnesota Democrat Amy Klobuchar saw it.
I want to note first that this hearing comes 6 days before Election Day, and it makes, I believe, we're politicizing, and the Republican majority is politicizing, which should actually not be a partisan topic. And I do want to thank the witnesses here for appearing, but also for the work that they're doing to try to encourage voting and to put out the correct information when the president and others are undermining vote by mail, something we're doing in every state in the country right now. Second point, Republicans failed to pass my Bipartisan Honest Ads Act, and the White House blatantly blocked the bipartisan election security bill that I had with Senator Lankford, as well as several other Republicans. And it's one of the reasons I think we need a new president. Third, my Republican colleagues in the Senate, many of them I work with very well on this committee, but we have had 4 years to do something when it comes to antitrust, privacy, local news, a subject that briefly came up, and so many other things.
So Kat Zakreski of The Washington Post, what ostensibly was this hearing about?
Peter, that's an actually kind of difficult question to answer. I feel like I have whiplash after watching that hearing. It was supposed to be focused on Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, a decades-old internet law that a lot of lawmakers on Capitol Hill are very interested in changing. But, you know, what we saw was a broad range of political attacks from lawmakers. Conservatives really zeroed in on accusations that these companies are biased against them and have made content decisions that discriminate against Republicans and benefit Democrats. And on the other side of the aisle, we saw Democrats raise major concerns about potential election interference and the rise and spread of extremism on these platforms.
So did the supposed monopoly powers of these tech platforms come up?
It came up in the sense that I think a lot of the questions got to the issue of, do these companies have too much power? Certainly there was a line of questioning, I believe from Republican Senator Mike Lee, that got at some of those issues when he was talking about whether or not these companies have too much power over speech. And then on the other side of the coin, on the Democratic side, we saw Senator Cantwell, the top Democrat on the committee, ask the companies a lot of questions about the impact that they have on local news, which is something that antitrust investigators in Washington and the House committee that has been exploring antitrust issues has looked into as well. But really, that took a backseat, I think, today to a lot of the concerns that are more immediate with the election coming up next week around these accusations of anti-conservative bias and concerns about election interference on the platforms.
Well, when it comes to election interference, what did the CEO say?
So the CEOs basically reiterated what they've told us before. They're seeing continued interference from foreign actors on their platforms heading into this election. Mark Zuckerberg talked about activity that they've seen from Russia, and as well as other companies that are learning from the tactics that Russia deployed in the 2016 election. So he cited some activity from Iran and China on the platform as well. Google spoke about similar activity and talked about the efforts that they had underway to work with the other companies as well as law enforcement on addressing the issue. And from Twitter's Jack Dorsey, we heard a bit about their the attempts they've discovered as well. He talked about a recent operation that they had disclosed earlier this year related to Iran. It was a small operation, but it's just these remarks signal how this continues to be a challenge for the companies and how they're trying to make sure they don't repeat some of the same mistakes they made in 2016 now that they have that hindsight heading into this presidential election.
So Kat Zakreski of The Washington Post, you've been covering this issue for quite a while. Are you starting to see a coalition around the viewpoint that, yes, Section 30 needs to be altered?
So what I would say is we're certainly seeing more openness on both sides of the aisle, and even from the tech CEOs themselves, to making changes to Section 230. I think, though, they're still not really in agreement about what those changes would look like. What was striking to me watching today's hearing was we heard a lot of criticism of Section 230, and there were some various proposals mentioned, but in general, there really hasn't been bipartisan consensus behind any of those efforts. And I think, you know, it's going to be a real challenge for the next Congress and whoever wins the White House next week to decide, you know, what the path forward on 230 looks like. We've heard both presidential candidates criticize Section 230. It's come under fire from both political parties. So there's certainly momentum to change this law, but we haven't seen a clear path forward for what exactly those changes would look like.
And over the time that you've been covering tech issues, have you noticed that the Democrats are starting to be more critical of the tech companies?
That's for certain. I mean, I think there was a lot of friendliness between the Democrats and the tech industry under the Obama administration, and we've seen a real shift since the 2016 election. I think the turning point really was the findings of election interference on the social media platforms, and that's caused the Democrats to take a harder look at tech's transgressions across the board. You know, they're more actively calling for tougher privacy legislation, reforms to Section 230, and of course, the House Democrats have been leading the major antitrust investigation into the tech companies. So I think it's still hard to say exactly what tech policy will look like in 2021 if we were to see a Democratic administration win in November, but you know, certainly tech is an issue they're thinking about, and the Biden campaign has signaled with some of its fundraisers recently having one with some of the Democrats who have been most active on antitrust issues in Congress, that it's something that it would be looking at more toughly enforcing in the tech industry.
It seemed that Jack Dorsey of Twitter spent most of the time on the hot seat today.
He was definitely the lightning rod and attracted a lot of the most scrutiny from these lawmakers. I think there were a couple of reasons for that. One is this was the first time we've heard from Jack Dorsey in front of Congress in more than 2 years. The last time was right before the 2018 midterm elections. And Twitter's political problems have really piled up since then, particularly these concerns that the company is biased against conservatives. The company for the first time started labeling President Trump's tweets to provide more context when the president shares misinformation earlier this year. And that has really ramped up tensions with Republicans. And there was also a lot of attention today on this issue of how the company handled a recent series of articles by the New York Post about alleged emails related to Hunter Biden. Now, the Washington Post hasn't independently verified those emails, but we heard a lot of criticism today from Republicans for the unusual steps that Twitter took to limit spread of that article.
Now, is this the first in a series of hearings?
I think it's likely it will be. You know, the Senate Judiciary Committee is planning to have Dorsey and Zuckerberg return in November to answer more questions about the handling of that New York Post story, since both companies took action to limit its spread. And so I think it's likely we'll see them back in the hot seat. And I think, you know, depending even whether it's Republicans in Congress who are leading the Senate next year or it's Democrats, both parties are interested in having these CEOs back. One of the things we heard from the CEOs today was that they encourage lawmakers, though, not to just have hearings with the CEOs, but also to have more hearings with lower level executives at the companies who are maybe full time focused on policy issues and might have a more in-depth understanding of some of the issues that the lawmakers are bringing up.
Now, Kat Zagrzewski, a logistical question. This was a virtual hearing. You're doing a lot of your work from home. How did you cover it?
I covered it virtually, actually. Yeah, it was a big shift for me to be watching one of these tech CEO hearings from home. I had gone in person to the Hill in July for the antitrust hearing, and thinking back to other big tech hearings with the CEOs, I remember being there for Jack Dorsey and Sheryl Sandberg in person, and it's so different watching it in this format, Peter. I mean, and it really led to a few hiccups throughout the day. I mean, we saw at the beginning of the hearing, Mark Zuckerberg really having trouble connecting. They had to take a several-minute recess in order for him to figure out what was going on with his internet connection and be able to stream into the hearing. We also saw that there were issues for some of the lawmakers, too. More of them were remote, with the Senate being on recess this time. And we saw that, you know, some struggled with their microphones being muted. The same problems that you and I and many are probably now encountering in this working from home world. So it, I think, is really a challenging format for lawmakers to and the CEOs to really have a productive discussion in.
Kat Zakreski covers technology for The Washington Post, WashingtonPost.com. And on Wall Street today, the Dow, NASDAQ, and S&P averages all dropped over 3% on fears of a renewed COVID pandemic. Now, the latest from the presidential campaigns, with just 5 days to go until the election, when Washington Today continues in a minute. And welcome back to Washington Today. Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden was in his hometown of Wilmington, Delaware, and he received a briefing from public health experts on the coronavirus as the number of cases increased. Joe Biden then gave remarks on the pandemic and what happened Tuesday night after a Donald Trump rally at an airport in Omaha, Nebraska, where buses had difficulty navigating the airport road.
Just look at what happened last night in Omaha. After the Trump rally ended, hundreds of people, including old Americans and children, were stranded in sub-zero freezing temperatures for hours. Several folks ended up in the hospital. It's an image that captures President Trump's whole approach to this crisis. He takes a lot of big pronouncements, and he makes a lot of big pronouncements, but they don't hold up. He gets his photo op, and then he gets out. He leaves everyone else to suffer the consequence of his failure to make a responsible plan. It seems like he just doesn't care much about it. And the longer he's in charge, the more reckless he gets. It's enough. It's time to change. Meanwhile, yesterday, the White House Science Office, and this stunned me, put out a statement listing ending the COVID-19 pandemic as a top accomplishment of President Trump's first term. Top accomplishment of Trump's first term. At the very moment when infection rates are going up almost every state in our union.
And that was former Vice President Joe Biden in Wilmington. He and his wife Jill then cast their votes early. Upon exiting the voting booth, Joe Biden took a reporter's question about unrest this week in Philadelphia following the police shooting of a black man.
Well, we just voted. Jill's off to do an interview, but thanks for taking the time to cover it, and as we are. What I say is that there is no excuse whatsoever for the looting and the violence, none whatsoever. I think to be able to protest is totally legitimate. It's totally reasonable, but I think that the looting is just, as the victim's father said, do not do this. It's not what my son, you're not helping. You're hurting. You're not helping my son. And there are certain things we're going to have to do as we move along. And I think I know the local folks in Philadelphia are thinking about it as well, and that is how we deal with, how do you diminish the prospect of lethal shooting in circumstances like the one we saw. That's going to be part of the commission I set up to determine how we deal with these changes. But there's no excuse for the looting.
And that was Joe Biden earlier today. The city of Philadelphia has seen two nights of protests and looting following the fatal police shooting of Walter Wallace Jr. President Trump was also asked about Philadelphia during a news conference at the Las Vegas Trump International Hotel.
It's a terrible thing. What I'm witnessing is terrible. And frankly, that the mayor or whoever it is that's allowing people to riot and loot and not stop them is also just a horrible thing. I saw the event. Everybody did. It was on television. It was a terrible event. I guess that's being looked at very strongly. We have the federal government is looking at it also. But the rioting in Philadelphia, you have to stop it. They have to stop it. It's a local thing, as you know. We don't send unless we're asked. If they ask for help, we'll be there very quickly. But they should bring in their National Guard if the police need help, and they should do something. You can't let that go on. Again, a Democrat-run state, a Democrat-run city, Philadelphia. We don't have that. We don't have it. The Republicans don't have it. And you'll have more and more of that, and you're going to have it, and you're going to have it strongly. You can't let that happen.
You mean the federal government is looking at the shooting, sir?
We're looking at the shooting, yes. We're looking at the shooting. And if asked to go in and help, we will do that. We have to be asked, as you know, by the governor. They should be able to handle it themselves. The police, I know the police very well in Philadelphia. I think they gave me an endorsement, and they're not allowed. They were told, I understand, to stand back, don't do anything. And people are breaking into stores and walking out with washing machines and walking out with all sorts of things, and it shouldn't be allowed. That's no way to do it. You got to have law and order. You've got to have respect for our police. The police were told to stand back. Now, maybe that's not so, but that's what I was told upon very good authority. You can't allow that to happen. We're watching it very closely, and we're waiting for a call. If they want help, we're there. We'll be in there within 1 hour. We're ready to go within 1 hour.
And that was the president in Las Vegas today. He then headed to Arizona for a couple of political rallies. And a new poll in that state shows Democrat Joe Biden with 49% to Donald Trump's 46%, with 3% favoring Libertarian candidate Joe Jurgensen and only 1% undecided. It is a state the Democrats are focusing on as well. Kamala Harris held a rally in Tucson.
Here in Arizona, 1 in 7 households is having a difficult time paying rent or were unable to pay rent last month. Here in Arizona, 1 in 4 businesses has gone out of business. And on the one hand, you have Joe Biden, who says, you want to talk to me about how the economy is doing? Well, then you need to tell me, how are working people doing? How are working families doing? Joe Biden, who says, you want to deal with the economy, then one, we will not raise taxes on anyone making less than $400,000 a year. We will also cut taxes for middle-class working people. We will make sure that no working family pays more than 7% of their income in child care. We will have a $15,000 tax credit for first-time home buyers, understanding that is the way and access for most families to achieve economic health and well-being that is intergenerational. That's how Joe Biden thinks about the economy. On the other hand, you have Donald Trump. Donald Trump, when asked about how's the economy doing, Donald Trump asks, well, how's the stock market doing? Donald Trump asks, how are rich people doing? Donald Trump, as his first order of business, passed a tax bill benefiting the top 1% and the biggest corporations of America, creating a $2 trillion deficit for all of us. Well, let me tell you something. When Joe and I are elected, we're about to get rid of that and invest that money in you, the American people.
And that was California Senator and Democratic Vice Presidential nominee Kamala Harris in Tucson, Arizona today. Now, Wisconsin is another close state this election. Joe Biden has a 5-point lead over President Trump, according to a new Marquette University Law School poll, 48-43. Vice President Mike Pence held a rally today at the Central Wisconsin Airport in Mosinee, Wisconsin.
Come November 3rd, just like 2016, we're going to show America that Wisconsin is Trump country. Am I right? I mean, here in Wisconsin, you believe we could be strong again. You believe we could be prosperous again. You said yes to President Donald Trump in 2016. And after last night and today, I just know Wisconsin's going to say yes to four more years of President Donald Trump in 2020. But it really is great to be with you all. If you want to take a seat, I got a lot on my mind. And I do want to say again, it really is great to be here with all of you, but also with a man who's got Wisconsin running through his veins, grew up on a dairy farm, went to UW River Falls, started a small business, answered a call to public service. He emerged as a conservative leader in the state assembly, but I'm going to tell you, he hit the ground running when he hit Washington, D.C. Give us another round of applause for Congressman Tom Tiffany. Congressman, we are grateful to you. What a winner. And thank you all again for coming out today. Just a joy to be with you all. You know, it's amazing to think how far we've come. 4 years ago, we inherited a military that had been hollowed out by devastating budget cuts. An economy that was struggling to break out of the slowest recovery since the Great Depression. Terrorism was on the rise around the world, and we'd witnessed a steady assault on our most cherished values. But in 3 short years, we rebuilt our military. We revived our economy. We secured our border, supported law enforcement, and we stood for life and liberty and the Constitution of the United States.
And that was Vice President Mike Pence in Mosinee, Wisconsin this afternoon. Now, there's been a lot of discussion about how long it might take to determine who won the presidency due to close states, counting of mail-in ballots, and potential legal challenges. Two election attorneys today weighed in, Bob Bauer, who is advising the Democrats, and Benjamin Ginsburg, a longtime Republican.
Do either of you or both of you think that this election will be resolved in everybody's mind by about midnight on election night next week? Bob, I'm looking at you on the screen first. Will the election be over at 12 o'clock so I can go to sleep at 12 o'clock knowing who the next president is?
With all the press that we've had about the potential for long delays, I think you could be reassured that sometime late on election night, there's a high likelihood that we'll know who's winning this election. And by the next day, that certainty will grow. I know there's been a lot of talk about how it's going to go on for months and months before anybody has an inkling of who will occupy the Oval Office beginning late January of this coming year, 2021. I don't think that's going to be the case.
Okay. Well, Ben, do you disagree with that?
Well, no, I don't disagree with that. I don't think you're going to get your midnight wish just because of the volume of absentee ballots and the fact that we'll need a few states in the Mountain and Pacific time zones to come in and with their results. But I do think that there will be a very clear idea of the winner by, say, Friday morning at the latest.
Okay. So last time in the year 2000, the famous Bush v. Gore decision and case, it usually had been the case that state courts were the ones that resolved election issues. In that situation, the federal courts got involved. Would you expect that if there were any disputes, the Bush v. Gore precedent would be such that Bush v. Gore and the federal courts would really rule, or do you think the state courts would go back to being the leading decision maker in these elections that are contested? Ben?
Well, I think, first of all, it's very rare that you get to a situation like Bush versus Gore where an outcome determinative state has such a narrow margin. And so most of the activity you're likely to see post-election really will be conducted under state law and state proceedings. I mean, after all, the way the system works is it begins in precincts and then builds up to counties and then goes to a state level. each state has its own set of laws. There is no national election law governing the time, place, and manner of elections. So I think it goes to states and their courts, except in the most extreme conditions.
Bob, you agree with that?
I do fundamentally agree. And I would add, I think the Bush versus Gore decision was clearly a very controversial one, and it raised significant institutional issues for the court. I think the court will be reluctant, particularly in a case where I suspect one of the candidates is going to have a very substantial popular vote margin, to appear to be interceding in the election and invite the sort of controversy that it encountered the last time.
And that was Bob Bauer along with Benjamin Ginsburg, veteran election law attorneys, today with the president of the Economic Club of Washington, David Rubenstein. Now stay with C-SPAN Networks up through and beyond election night for campaign coverage. In other Washington news, the FBI is accusing eight people of acting as Chinese agents who stalked and harassed U.S. citizens and legal residents from China to try to get them to return to face trial on potential corruption charges. Assistant Attorney General for National Security John Demures led a news conference today at the Justice Department in Washington.
Today I'm joined by FBI Director Chris Wray, and remotely by the acting U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of New York, Seth Ducharme, to announce charges against eight individuals for acting as agents of the People's Republic of China while taking part in an illegal Chinese law enforcement operation known as Fox Hunt. Five of these individuals were arrested across the country this morning. The rest, we believe, are in China. Since 2014, at the direction of Chinese General Secretary Xi Jinping, China has been engaged in a global operation known as Fox Hunt. China describes Fox Hunt as an international anti-corruption campaign in which it seeks to locate legitimate fugitives around the world to bring them back for trial in China. But this is certainly not the whole story, and oftentimes it simply isn't true. Some of these individuals may well be wanted on traditional criminal charges, and some of them may even be guilty. But in many instances, the hunted are opponents of Communist Party Chairman Xi, political rivals, dissidents, critics. And in either event, the operation is a clear violation of the rule of law and international norms. Rather than work with U.S. authorities for assistance with recognized criminal cases, as responsible nations do, China resorts to extra-legal means and unauthorized, often covert, law enforcement operations. Without coordination with our government, China's repatriation squads enter the sovereign territory of the United States, surveil and locate the alleged fugitives, and deploy intimidation and other tactics to force them back into China, where they would face certain imprisonment or worse following illegitimate trials. There are many established ways that rule of law-abiding nations conduct international law enforcement activity. This simply isn't one of them.
And that was Assistant Attorney General for National Security John Demers. The Justice Department says the victims of China's Operation Fox Hunt include a man in New Jersey who received a threatening note that read, quote, "If you are willing to go back to the mainland and spend 10 years in prison, your wife and children will be safe." With regard to U.S. and China tensions, National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien was asked today how bad it could get.
In our competition with China, are we now in a new Cold War? Is it a new Cold War? Is it going to be different from the one with the Soviet Union, or is it going to be in many ways similar?
I think it's going to be different. I don't think it necessarily needs to be a Cold War. And what the president has said time and again, and what I've said time and again, is we want great relations with China. The Chinese people are wonderful people. I mean, hundreds of thousands of them have studied here. We have many Americans who are of Chinese descent. China has traditionally been an American ally. We fought together in World War II. So we'd love to have a great relationship with China. The problem that we have is, and it's not even the Chinese Communist Party, it's the Chinese Communist Party's efforts to spread their tentacles, not just across China, but across the world, and to control us the way they control their own people, and to continue to steal our intellectual property. And Christopher Wray, our director of the FBI, recently said, Chinese theft of American intellectual property is the greatest wealth transfer in human history. And he's 100% right. I mean, there's no analog to it anywhere in history. And, you know, it's just not fair. China's a great country with hardworking people and smart people and incredibly capable people. Do your own inventions. Do your own innovation. Create your own technology. Don't steal it from us without paying for it. I mean, that's not honorable under any, you know, moral
under
system.
Under any system.
Don't steal the hard work of the American people or of folks in Europe or Africa, or wherever technology has been developed. Take it back to China. Don't pay for it. Then use it to create competing projects. Subsidize them and send those products back to the country from which you stole the technology and put the folks out of business who developed the technology to begin with. I mean, it's this horrible cycle. So you're getting clobbered twice if you're an inventor. You get your invention is stolen with no license fee and no patent fee or no compensation, and then your market's undercut by a state subsidized product that comes back using your own technology. And either you or your licensee is put out of business.
That's
a terrible thing. So that's the sort of thing that has to stop for China to truly become a great power. Great countries don't build themselves on theft. And we've got to put an end to that.
That was National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien at a discussion hosted by the Hudson Institute. Now, also today, Al Jazeera reports, quote, that nearly 6,000 Afghan civilians were killed or wounded in the first 9 months of the year as heavy fighting between government forces and Taliban fighters raged on despite efforts to find peace. Former First Lady Laura Bush talked today about minority and women's rights in Afghanistan at a program sponsored by the George W. Bush Institute and the Atlantic Council. She was asked specifically about the Trump administration's policy of holding peace talks with the Taliban.
We've talked a little bit about education. You've highlighted that. And there have been so many other areas of progress for women, of course. What do you think the people of Afghanistan stand to lose if those gains are reversed?
Well, everything. They'll lose everything. I'm not that happy about the idea of negotiating with the Taliban. I think we should be negotiating with the legitimate government, elected government, of Afghanistan. I think that we forget that America gives people a certain prestige if we negotiate with the Taliban. Then we're in some ways saying they're important, more important than the elected government. And do we want peace there? Absolutely. Would we like our troops to come home? Of course. But we still have troops in Berlin. Mm-hmm. Many, many years after World War II. We've kept troops in various places in the world. And not that I'm suggesting we have to do that in Afghanistan, but they're a very fragile democracy. And there are a lot of people, the Taliban, obviously, that would rather take over and have it be like it was before, mm-hmm. a failed country. And they've made a lot of progress. And so I hope we'll continue to support the legitimate government of Afghanistan.
And that was former First Lady Laura Bush earlier today. And finally tonight, according to Politico, Miles Taylor has come forward and revealed himself to be anonymous, the mysterious Washington official who has claimed to be working within the administration to restrain Trump's impulses for the good of the country. Donald Trump is a man without character, tweeted Taylor, the former chief of staff at the Department of Homeland Security in the Trump administration. It's why I wrote a warning, and it's why me and my colleagues have spoken out against him for months. It's time for everyone to step out of the shadows. That's a report from Politico. Well, thanks for joining us tonight on Washington Today. Download the free C-SPAN radio app to listen anywhere and find this program as a podcast by searching Washington Today wherever you get your podcasts or at cspan.org/podcasts. Have a good night.